This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. If you're having any sort of trouble in your life, you might benefit from therapy. And I'm here to tell you that BetterHelp is a great service, whether you're feeling anxious, depressed, or just like you're not the best version of yourself. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I know personally it's a great service because I used it myself for about 2 years, and it really made a difference. So visit betterhelp.com/TRI for The Reason Interview. Do it today, and you'll get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/TRI, HELP.com/TRI. A link is also in the show notes. My guest today on The Reason Interview is journalist and podcaster Jesse Single, who first came to national prominence in 2018 when he wrote a cover story for The Atlantic titled When Children Say They're Trans. It was meticulously reported, but it questioned various aspects of contemporary activism and created a firestorm. Since then, Jesse has emerged as a fierce advocate for free speech, open debate, and honesty about the use and limits of social science in journalism and public discourse. 3 years ago, he and Katie Herzog started hosting the great podcast Blocked and Reported. Check the show notes for an interview with both of them from back then. And in 2021, Jesse published the excellent book, The Quick Fix, Why Fad Psychology Can't Fix Our Social Ills. There's a link in the show notes to an episode, to an interview I did with him about that, too. This episode, that one that you're about to hear, was recorded in front of a live audience at a small gathering in New York City. We talk about Jesse's work and research, a little bit about his biography, where he's from, where he went to school, all of that kind of stuff, how he came by his commitment to truth over advocacy, and how we might all push back against cancel culture and other forms of soft and hard censorship. Here is The Reason Interview with Jesse Single. So, Jesse, the Atlantic article on trans, it was both, it was on people who were transitioning, but also detransitioners.
Yeah.
In 2018. What was the title of that? Do you remember?
I think it was When Your Daughter Says She's Trans, but then the Atlantic changed it to When Your Child Says They're Trans for online outrage reasons.
All right. What was the, you know, this was one of these things. I remember reading that when it came out, and then there was a firestorm after it because it was called transphobic. It was called insensitive. And I remember having the same response when Katie Herzog had a piece that she had a similar reaction to. And I was like, I must be reading the wrong piece because your piece is incredibly well-researched. It's incredibly sensitive and thoughtful and in no way is transphobic. But what was the gist of the article? And then why did it occasion such an outpouring against you?
Yeah, the gist of the article was that there are obviously some people who are helped by transition, but as we've started transitioning kids by putting them on puberty blockers and hormones at younger and younger ages, there's some dispute about the best way to do that, particularly the question of how much assessment a kid should have before you put them on blockers or hormones. Like, how much should you evaluate their mental health, try to figure out what the origin of their feelings about their gender is and stuff like that. And the editorial process was like, we ran a little bit of a gauntlet to, you know, cross every T, dot every I, so that we wouldn't be accused of transphobia on Twitter. And as you know, that worked out. Nobody complained about it. Glowing reaction, multiple awards, all that. No, but I mean, I've had the same experience where a lot of the time it's an easy thing for a writer to say, but I feel like people are responding to a piece I didn't write. Like 2 or 3 weeks ago, Vox wrote an article where they said that I didn't talk to any happily transitioned trans people in the article. I talked to half a dozen of them. So I don't know. The online rumor mill can be difficult. But
what did you find? Because part of the article was about people who were not happy with transitioning and went back. So, you know, what was that about?
Yeah, there's a group of detransitioners. They tend to be natal females, and they think that, you know, it's difficult to be a young woman going through puberty, as we both know. It's really tough.
No.
And they think
I've been on puberty blockers my entire life, so I have that to look forward to.
That's why you're doing such that in retirement. High childlike reedy voice.
Yes.
Their theory is that societal misogyny or their own fears about becoming a woman made them think it might be easier to be a man. And that idea that in some cases, gender dysphoria can be sparked not by some like deep internal kernel, but by exterior stuff, that's actually been something gender clinicians have been noticing for decades. It shouldn't be that controversial, but as this has gotten more and more politicized, that's now seen as something you're sort of not allowed to say in polite liberal company, even though more and more detransitioners are coming out being like, yeah, this happened to me. A version of this happened to me.
What is the number on detransitioning? And I guess to start, how many people are trans according to the latest figures? And then how many who identify or become trans detransition?
So the most reliable figure is about 1%. The problem is there's these really bad polls that ask the question in such a vague way. You get figures as high as like 10% for Generation Z, because there's a difference between feeling like you have a deep-seated mismatch between your biological sex and your identity. And there are, on the other hand, there's like kids who, you know, just feel they don't quite feel that masculine. And I think in 2023, one way to interpret not feeling that masculine is to say you're genderqueer or non-binary. So the short answer is we don't know, but the most common estimate is about 1% of the population.
And then how many detransition?
We have no idea. So you'll see people throw around figures like less than 1% of people who go on hormones or get surgery regret it. Those figures are complete bullshit.
And it's just because they're made up.
They're based on studies. So, for example, one of them comes from a study where if you take the whole sample of the study, 33% of the population was lost to follow-up, meaning we have no idea how they're doing. If you lose 33% of your cohort to follow-up, you can't then say, well, only 1% of them regret it. You don't know.
On that question of, is it true that it's more common for natal girls to transition to natal boys or, you know,
yeah.
Well, I'm not sure of the exact language, but that's more common than men transitioning to or male to female.
Traditionally, youth gender clinics, it was more likely to be natal males. So people, you know, kids born boys. These days, in some clinics, you're seeing ratios where it's almost 70 or 80% natal females. And that's weird. And no one has really come up with an explanation for that.
And it's weird just because you would assume if it's a normal distribution, it would be like 50-50.
Yeah, there's sort of no a priori reason to think it wouldn't be that far off from 50-50, but it's like incredibly skewed, 70 or 80%.
One of the things that was interesting in the story, and you know, it's actually for free on The Atlantic, so you can read it, but a lot of the girls were saying that there weren't enough different types of femininity available to them. And as somebody, I'm turning 60 in August, so I've been around forever.
You are forever. 60?
6-0, yeah.
How do you look? Yeah. You look younger than I.
You know what? I have a lot of blood boys.
There we go.
So, you know, or girls. I don't discriminate on that. I'll take the blood of anyone who's at least 40 years younger than me. But beyond that, what was interesting to me as somebody who's older, it's, you know, compared to, say, 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, it's so much easier to be either a non-conventional male or female, it would seem to me. But that is not the lived experience of a lot of people, I guess.
No, it almost seems like there was a peak where boys could dress like girls or vice versa, you know, 15, 20 years ago or something. And now we're sort of cycled back in the other direction where my co-host, Katie Herzog, claims that, you know, she came up in sort of radical circles, like real lefty circles. She says, I forget the figure she gave, like 80% of her lesbian friends now identify as men or non-binary. It's become a lot harder for whatever reason to be, especially a woman who is gender non-conforming.
What drew you to that topic?
I just want to hurt marginalized people.
Okay.
That's my main goal.
Good job.
If I see someone who's downtrodden, I sort of want to step on their throat, stuff like that.
So you want to afflict the afflicted and comfort the comfortable.
Yeah, journalism,
that's what journalism is all about.
No, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've always been interested in like why people are wrong about things and in controversial subjects. I shouldn't say always. In my early 20s, I was like a by the books liberal working at a liberal think tank.
Which one?
Center for American Progress.
Ah.
I had, what was that murmur? Like if I said I worked at the Nazi party, I wouldn't have gotten such a negative response. Yeah, but you know, my college columns were like, George W. Bush is bad, mm-hmm. gay marriage is good. I believe in both those stances still, but I sort of think.
You can't abort your children with nuclear arms, that kind
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly, yes. No, I sort of think like, what's the point of having a platform and being a journalist if you're not willing to look into controversial stuff other people aren't willing to look into.
So what happened to you that you kind of moved out of a phase of being just a doctrinaire conventional thinker to being interested in figuring out what the complexity of a subject is?
Yeah, when I was like 25-ish, I was at the Boston Globe working as sort of a permalancer for the editorial page. And I was getting less and less interested in sort of saying who's right and who's wrong and more interested in figuring out why people disagree. And I discovered the work of John Haidt, who's like one of the, you know, biggest social psychologists for that question of why people disagree. And you know, long story short, that led me to get a degree in public policy where I acquired some very bare bones basic quantitative chops that would let me sort of evaluate research and try to figure out who's right, not just who's right and who's wrong, but why we're wrong about stuff. And that's what motivated me.
Are we, based on that, are we actually more polarized than we are in the past? Or is it simply we think we are because you can see everybody disagreeing?
I would tend towards it's a little bit overstated. I mean, there's this idea of sort of the exhausted majority. Mm-hmm. Some political scientist in Arizona came up with that. That's like the normal people. As shit gets crazier and crazier, they mm-hmm. just drop out of politics or drop right. off of social media. They're not interested. So I can see it both ways. I know the partisans seem to be louder and have more of a platform than ever before. It certainly seems that way.
I had asked Jesse to, you know, what's his quintessential work in preparation for this? And he mentioned the 2018 Atlantic article. You also talked about your book, The Quick Fix, which came out in 2021. I interviewed you for that during COVID. I can remember I was in LA and it was a very weird kind of world.
Yeah.
The Quick Fix, what's the subtitle?
Why Fad Psychology Can't Cure Our Social Ills.
Yeah. And what did you want it to be? Why your daughter thinks she's a man?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no, why I want to afflict the afflicted.
Yes. What's the thesis of The Quick Fix?
Basically that like psychologists come up with these ideas for how to fix society or help fix society, you know, how to fix education, how to fix racial inequality, all that stuff. And a lot of those ideas are just bullshit. So a lot of the book is case studies of psychologists getting things very wrong, often at huge expense. And then that ties into a broader discussion of the so-called replication crisis, which is the finding that something like half of psychology's published findings don't replicate and are probably false. So psychology is one of many fields of science that is in like a sort of total epistemic crisis. And we really don't even know what we don't know at this point. It's a little bit, I don't know. It's bad.
Is there reason with the replication crisis, is there reason to believe that things have gotten worse over time? Or is it just that we are more aware of the bad design of a lot of studies?
We're much more aware of the bad design of studies. So like, I think it's going to turn out that like, any study published in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you have mm-hmm. to take with a giant grain of salt. The methods have gotten a lot better, and we now have folks who know what makes for biased research, which is important.
In The Quick Fix, which is a fantastic book, and it covers things like real fads, like power posing, and a lot of stuff that came out as YouTube or TED Talks and things like that. But there's a lot of discussion of Martin Seligman, who's the father of positive psychology. He trained John Haidt and a bunch of other people. What's your case against Martin Seligman, and what was the negative effect that he had that you write about most in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so part of my critique is that positive psychology is just sort of like a field that doesn't have high standards. You could say that about a lot of fields, but my chapter was about a program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. This has cost taxpayers something like $350 million. Although in my book, I point out that's like two fighter jets. So like, it's sort of funny money. But the idea is that this is taking the ideas of positive psychology and using them to prevent soldiers with PTSD from killing themselves. That's what they said this program could do, Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. And if you look deeply into it, there is no reason to expect that is true. And the army rolled it out to every soldier in the army, to a million young men, highly susceptible, mostly men, susceptible to trauma without any pilot testing, assuming it would work. And there's no evidence it worked.
Why did they do that?
This was around 2008 or 2009. There was like this crisis of returning veterans killing themselves or more rarely killing others. So there was a real need to figure out a way to treat PTSD. And, you know, Marty Seligman, who's considered a pioneering social psychologist, was in the right place at the right time to sort of pull the Pentagon's ear and say, like, I have a program that can fix this. And they believed him. And it's, I'm sort of to this day surprised it hasn't been a bigger scandal, because that's a lot of money on a very vital subject that I think was totally wasted.
Blocked and Reported started
what's
in
that? Sorry, it,
what? Yeah, it's your side hustle, I suppose. Okay. Right. But Blocked and Reported started in 2020. Tell us about it. Why did you start it, and what's the goal of it?
Yeah, Katie Herzog, I think we first met because she reached out to me because she was also working on a story about the trans stuff. And I think I was like a little bit standoffish because I was like, is she gonna scoop me? Are we competing? I don't remember exactly what happened, but it was during lockdown in 2020 when I was actually listening to a lot of The Fifth Column. I don't know where Welch is.
Some Matt Welch is here, Reason's Own.
I mean, not a good guy, but a pretty good podcaster, I would say. Yeah,
that's about right.
Wandering around outside during the pandemic, I got a lot of sucker from listening to The Fifth Column, because they would sort of say stuff that a lot of people were thinking about the ways in which media was melting down. Around that time, Katie and I decided to just record a podcast and see what happened. I don't want to say we thought it would be a failure. You know, I probably hoped it would eventually represent like a nice little chunk of change, but we did not think it would catch on and sort of become our main day job. And I don't know. I feel like we were very much in the right place at the right time, because you know, pandemic, early to mid-2020 was sort of the peak of a lot of media craziness that we just sort of fed off of.
What was the craziness was partly about the pandemic and about COVID, but also about race matters, because George Floyd happened and there was the summer of racial reckoning. Is that what fueled the craziness, or did it just kind of pour a little gas on something that was already happening?
I'm not sure. I mean, obviously George Floyd, it was a horrible video and a traumatic video, and people responded to it in a certain way. But, within media, stuff got really, really weird very quickly. And not all of the stories have come out even. It got like a little bit Maoist. I don't want to throw that term around, but people were really eager to hear folks talk about this in like a normal way, rather than the way a lot of people do, which is just like keep their heads down, try not to get caught up in it themselves, or pretend that any argument made on behalf of social justice is sort of inherently righteous. So I think that's where we found our audience.
Yeah. One of the episodes that you say you're most proud of was about Jacob Blake, who was the black man who was shot by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. What went into that episode? Again, this is also, if you go to the Blocked and Reported website or Google it, you can listen to this. It's a really interesting and amazingly well-researched kind of look at that incident, which, you know, inflamed Kenosha, but also the country in a lot of ways. What did you find, and what was the major media narrative missing?
Yeah, this was like an example of how if you build a smart audience, they can make you better. Because I fucked this up at first. So we did an episode right after Blake was shot and the rioting popped off, where I basically said, like, having watched the video, obviously the cops did something wrong here. Like, something, they have to have been able to handle this better and differently. And I think that's like a safe assumption.
He was shot outside the apartment of his girlfriend.
His ex, yeah.
Yeah, he was getting in a van and the police were right behind him and shot him 17 times, or shot 17
many
bullets
times,
or something.
And if you just watch the video, it looks horrible. Because it looks like it just cuts, like, with them about to shoot him. So after we did this episode about the chaos in Kenosha, and I said, like, clearly the cops, I basically implied the cops aired badly, and people should be skeptical of cops. Anything involving cop shooting, I mean, I'm at a Reason gathering. You should be skeptical of the state use of force. I'm not opposed to that.
Look, everybody here either hates the cop or is an undercover cop.
I was going to say, if any of you are cops, you have to say so. So let me know. We got an email or two from listeners that were basically like, there's a little bit more to the story than you think. You should look into it. I got a little bit obsessed, especially with like the chain of events, the rioting, and then Kyle Rittenhouse, all this stuff that wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. But at the time, Democratic candidates were flying to Jacob Blake's bedside. Long story short, if you read the full accounts of what happened, both Kenosha, the Kenosha police's sort of internal review, they also hired a former Obama police reform guy to do an independent review. It was a justified shooting. Like, it really was. If you look at the full timeline of what happened, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that he was basically fighting off cops. They tried to tase him. It didn't work. He was wrestling with cops. He was about to drive off with a kid. They didn't know whose kid it was. It was his kid, but he didn't have custody of them. He had previously been wanted for sexually assaulting his girlfriend. It was complicated. He was at this cookout hanging out with his girlfriend. They had a complicated relationship. Something went sour. That's what caused her to call the police. But to think the cops should have acted differently, you have to say you're okay with the idea of them letting this guy who had already physically resisted arrest, and again, these are warrants for sexual assault, drive off with maybe someone else's kid, possibly leading to a high-speed chase. And I really am a bleeding heart on criminal justice stuff, but I don't know and have never heard like a credible account of what else the cops were supposed to do.
Yeah. Do you, what was the response to that episode?
A lot of people hate Katie and me, but they don't seem to actually listen to the podcast. I guess I'd be too...
Mostly, then they would really hate you.
They would really hate me, yeah. No, mostly positive review. I think there's a real appetite, even among, you know, the sort of like Democratic voter who might not want to think the cops didn't do anything wrong. Like, people want honesty, and I think they value it.
Do you think, are we, when it comes to things like criminal justice issues and crime, you know, obviously we're talking in New York where there are some parts of crime rates are going up, others are not, but are we in a better place, you know, to have serious discussions about law enforcement, including, you know, cops going too far or criminality getting out of control?
I'm not like an expert in this area, but my sense was like, you might know more about this than I do. Even before Trayvon Martin, I felt like there was sort of a left-right agreement that certain excesses had to be scaled back. I think this storyline that until this like mass wave of protest, this was like an underappreciated issue is sort of false. And I'm not sure if like what has happened since George Floyd has done more good or more harm. I think you could sort of argue either way. I know in a lot of places where there was initially energy toward police reform, like Eric Adams type figures have since seized the reins again, which tells you something about what voters want.
Yeah, it's interesting when Michael Brown was killed in a police scuffle in Missouri, the first politicians who talked about that were Rand Paul and Justin Amash. Yeah. Congress, even the senators from Missouri didn't talk about it. And that, I think, was not only the beginning of the long kind of Black Lives Matter movement moment, but it started showing that there was agreement that, you know, bad policing. And it turns out that the Michael Brown case was not bad policing. You know, the Obama Justice Department investigated that, but that was the start of a conversation that certain excesses need to be reeled in.
Yeah.
But in that episode about Jacob Blake, it was interesting because you say to Katie, "Are you like we got it wrong because we rolled with the kind of media narrative that cops were always wrong." How do you know, like? How do you know that you're not just now going in the other direction? Because that seems to be more current.
Yeah. I mean, that's always
a risk. This is an epistemology question.
Well, it's also this question of audience capture, where, you know, you just sort of do what your audience wants you to do because they're paying the bills. I don't know. I think you need to take every incident on a case-by-case basis and try to investigate it to the best of your ability. If I had looked into the Jacob Blake case and found that there was obvious, you know, error on the part of the cops. And there was one part of it where they probably could have handled it a little bit better. But I'd like to think I'm independently minded, but no one is actually independently minded.
Could you talk a bit about the community that surrounds Blocked and Reported? Because this is also something that is, you know, actually new in journalism. Part of it is because of Substack and podcasts, you know, things like The Fifth Column, Blocked and Reported. There are other examples where there's a rich community that kind of aggregates around that. You mentioned audience capture. Are you worried that when you are kind of, when people are paying for your product, that you're just going to give them what they want?
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to be careful about that. And that's why we try not to overdose on certain subjects. But overall, I've been really gratified at the idea of like, what I really like is inducing in others that feeling I had listening to The Fifth Column during the pandemic, of like not feeling so alone, being like there's other people who feel the same way. And I think that's something we hear pretty frequently from folks, like, thank you for making me feel less crazy and less alone. And I really like that. I do think that one of the downsides of this sort of crowdfunding model is if you get too close to your audience or don't, you know, retain some skepticism about their views, we could probably name some folks who have gone a little bit crazy because of the feedback they've gotten on Twitter and stuff.
I can't, but you
can. I could, yeah.
And when your fans start mailing you body parts, that's when you feel like, maybe we need a break.
I think it depends on the body part.
Okay, fair enough. You mentioned some of your intellectual heroes being people like John Haidt. You've also told me that Philip K. Dick was an early influence. And I am fond, I have a regular thing that I tweet out, more signs we're living in a Philip K. Dick universe. One of the first ones was when Jose Canseco, the former great baseball player, was arrested, and this was the headline, Jose Canseco arrested while driving diapered goats in an unlicensed car. And I was like,
we've all been there.
That sounds like a Philip K. Dick story.
Yeah.
What is it about Philip K. Dick that you find interesting?
I probably first read him when I was like, I don't know, when you're 13 and 14, I think you just love weirdness. And you love like someone who writes stuff that no one else could quite write. I think that was probably what drew me to it. Just like some weird part of my brain that hadn't quite been tickled in that way yet.
He also does seem to be, I mean, his characters are always kind of never sure if they're experiencing reality being dreamed by somebody else or just insane. And that does kind of describe the current moment in a broad terms, right?
And a lot of forces, I don't know. Yes, it's very easy to feel. I was going to say a lot of forces trying to make us feel insane. That's not right. We have a lot of forces trying to make us feel like we're correct and that we should feel mad about everything. But that's like a form of madness on its own.
Yeah. You also mentioned Elizabeth Loftus, the psychologist. Tell us who she is and why she matters to you.
Yeah, so there was this panic over daycare centers supposedly torturing and killing children, engaging in satanic rituals. And a lot of this was based on the idea that years later you could uncover someone's memories. This in retrospect bankrupt idea that, you know, when you were three, a daycare provider inflicted a horrific trauma on you and nailed you to a tree and let squirrels eat your face. And then you just forgot about it entirely.
Right.
Until a clinician uncovered the memory. So she was just a real skeptic of this stuff at a time when it was hard to be a skeptic of it, because when scientific questions get mixed with like political causes or activism, the results are often very ugly. And in this case, it was like, how could you care about sex assault victims, if you don't believe
Why would you question that?
Yes.
Why would they make this
It was
up?
A cover of, I want to say Miss Magazine or Elle or something. It was like, we believe the children. That's it. You can't not believe them. So, yeah.
Have you ever met her or interacted with her?
I have not, no. I'd like to. Is she here?
Actually, you did. She took care of you in your child care.
Yes. Yeah.
She did some fucked up shit. And we have her here right now, too. Yeah. She's coming
in honor
Satan.
Of Jerry Springer.
You've also mentioned Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. What do you like about their work?
Yeah, these are a couple of Israeli psychologists who sort of founded behavioral economics, and they were, you know, among the first researchers to show not only that humans are irrational, but that we're, as another psychologist put it, predictably irrational. Like our brains are biased, our information processing is biased, but it's biased in a way where we can predict how people will be off about something. And that, I don't know, I sort of found it mind-blowing at the time because like I was trying to figure out why people disagree about politics. And once you realize how noisy our brains are and how hard it is to sort of adopt a cold reptilian logic-based approach to everything.
Which we never quite get to, right?
No, never.
I mean, we're brain soaked in emotion or something like that. And then you also talk fondly of Carl Sagan. What did you like about Carl Sagan?
Yeah, I think like before I got to where I am now, which is like everyone's wrong for different interesting reasons, I had to go through a phase of like, man, religion's bullshit. If people could just be rational and secular, the world would be a great place, which I don't really believe anymore. But he was like a big influence just in terms of skepticism in general, which remains an important part of, I don't know, my approach to everything.
We're going to go, we'll open it up for questions in a minute. What's coming down the pike for you? What are some of your future projects you're working on that you would share with us?
just, you know, there's going to be more stuff on gender. I'm trying to better understand past medical crazes that have gone wrong. I'm reading a really interesting book about a, it's horrible, but there was a very intriguing looking treatment for metastatic breast cancer that for a while women were subjected to horrible treatment that would leave you, like it killed 10 to 15% of the people who did it. And there was a lot of activism to make sure women had access to it. Years later, maybe a decade and a half later, when the high quality studies came in, it turned out this was no better than traditional chemotherapy. So all these women were subjected to this pretty torturous medical process for no good reason. So I'm trying to learn more about how the medical establishment gets stuff wrong.
So you're really lightening it up.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Let's have some questions for Jesse. Tell me your question. I'm going to respond or I'll repeat it. Jerry, please. So the... Yeah. So two parts. One, there's been a serious decline in the number of journalists over the past 30 years or so. How do you feel about that? And then, you know, there's a move towards getting rid of objectivity, even a pretense of objectivity in journalism.
Yeah. I mean, so I think for a while, I could be wrong, but I think like the absolute implosion of like regional and local newspapers was sort of counteracted by like there were more and more jobs as a web producer at BuzzFeed or HuffPo or whatever. So I think for a while, the raw number of jobs was going up. They just weren't good jobs that required actual reporting. I assume now that like, you know, BuzzFeed and Vice News and everything are in trouble, the number of journalists is going down. And I think that's a major catastrophe because don't get me wrong, Blocked and Reported, probably the best podcast ever, right?
Yeah.
No, everyone should subscribe. I have a lot of fun making it, but we don't do... If there's a scandal in Nashua, New Hampshire city council, there's nobody left to cover that. And there's 10,000 cities like Nashua, New Hampshire around the country. There's no one there sort of watching the watchers. And I think that's a catastrophe. And there's going to be a lot of scandals that happen because there's no local or regional journalism left. So, I mean, my short answer is that's horrible. And I don't think, other than sort of like stopgappy things like ProPublica, which does really good reporting on a nonprofit basis, no one has figured out how to fund journalism. Like Katie and I are, I'm really grateful for how we're doing. I'm grateful for how the Fifth Column is doing. None of us are doing like resource intensive, in-depth journalism, and that's a problem.
What about the shift away from objectivity to, you know, subjectivity?
This is like, there's a lot of situations where I bet everyone, your freshman year in college, there's a stoned guy who says things that sound profound, but then the next day when you're not high, you realize they're not that profound. It's definitely true there's no such thing as objectivity. It's definitely true that objectivity has been used to service evil ends. We should still strive for something like objectivity. We should recognize our biases. We should realize often there's a truth of the matter. And there's been a move in the last 4 years, like, I mean, the youth gender thing, I don't want to go down this whole rabbit hole, but it's a really complicated scientific debate. And if you read a lot of the coverage of it, it is written by journalists who see themselves as advocates advocating for transgender kids' access to these treatments, which is like a really question-begging, activism-driven approach to a controversial, complicated subject. And there's already a lot of like activists and PR folks in the world. I think journalists are supposed to do something different.
Do you see, you know, the success of Blocked and Reported or your Substack? Is that a sign that there's a market or an appetite for, you know, and not, it's not like you're reactionary or anything, but just, you know, kind
Katie
of
is,
a more, but... yeah, increasingly, but, you know, just to kind of trying to figure things out.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've had some success. The Fifth Column, Mike Pesca is in the audience. Mm-hmm. He has a strong follow.
No.
Okay. Oh, I thought he was clapping for himself.
Yeah, he was. He was. He put his hands under his arms very quick. Okay. Another question, please. Okay. So the question is, do you see the, you know, kind of trans debate, which, you know, it polarizes people, but there's people on the right and the left. And is that a kind of power grab to dominate the discourse rather than getting it to doctors and parents and children or subjects?
Yeah, I think this issue has, I don't know how to say this politely, is it attracts some like really bad opportunistic people who don't have, I mean, maybe they think they have like kids' best interests at heart, but they don't. It's just a really good way to amass power for yourself, whether it's because you're calling trans activists groomers and making ugly comments about trans people, or on the other side, pretending that anyone who has questions with this is a bigot and part of a transphobic conspiracy. So yeah, in broad strokes, I agree with you. I think I hear a lot about the idea that this should be a decision made by, you know, families, parents, and doctors. Yes and no. I mean, doctors, in like your local doctor, I hate to say it, but he isn't like an expert on research methods or like what the best treatment is. And I see a lot of doctors, especially on Twitter, where everyone's dumb, just saying things that are not true, including doctors at places like Mass General Hospital and Stanford. So I think there's no excuse for like really careful, systematic evidence reviews and stuff like that. It gets nerdy. I can already see people falling asleep when I mention that, but like that's the only way out of a medical controversy.
Do you, what do you think about when a number of states now are passing laws to prevent kind of gender affirming, I guess it's mental health as well as regular healthcare? Are you in favor of that or not?
No, I mean, I've been opposed to this for the start for a few reasons. Like one of which is like, I just don't trust. So there's a whistleblower in Missouri, Washington University Transgender Center, Jamie Reed. I find her trustworthy. I've interviewed her, but what's his name? Andrew Bailey, the Attorney General of Missouri, has latched onto this issue. And he's made this a keystone of his 2025, I think January 2025, he has to get elected. He was appointed as AG. I don't want someone using this as political leverage. And I think that's not, in much the same way, I don't trust, frankly, GLAAD to be an impartial observer of the evidence and to publish good thing about the evidence. Why would I trust a Republican seeking re-election on the basis of his fight against wokeness to make the right decisions about this? I also think that, as anyone could have predicted, this rash of state laws has made the conversation much more hysterical. It's, look, this was a toxic issue in 2018 when my article came out, but because there's so much misinformation and hysteria, you now have people who literally think their kids are going to die because of Republican state legislatures. It shouldn't surprise us we can't talk about this.
What do you make of the UK TERF movement, the trans exclusionary radical feminists?
Yeah, I can explain what it is.
What's that? Okay. Okay. So,
well, I don't know what the UK is.
What do you think about the UK TERF movement?
Yes.
And the traction it seems to have gained over there compared to the United States.
Okay. So I'm not an expert in this. A TERF is a trans exclusionary radical feminist. It's a radical feminist who doesn't view trans women as women. In my experience, it is often used just as like a rhetorical cudgel. I've been called a TERF a lot. Even though I'm not a radical feminist, I hate women. I'm open about that on the podcast.
Right. But you are exclusionary.
I'm very exclusionary. That part's accurate. My read on what happened in the UK is that the conservative government there, actually, I can't remember the years. I'm trying to make this not boring. There's a procedure in the UK to change your sex legally. You get a gender recognition certificate. You don't actually need that to like use the bathroom you want to use or to be treated decently. It's sort of a bit of a process. The Tories were like, we should make this process easier. We should move towards self-ID. If this policy went through, I don't think this happens a lot. I'm just explaining what the policy is. Someone like me could go fill out a form, say I'm a woman now, and be treated like completely as a woman, even in sensitive situations where we would usually acknowledge some nuance. My read on the situation is when news got out of what that proposed policy was, there was a backlash to it. All the UK polling suggests that this is a very unpopular policy. So to me, it's less that the TERFs gained power somehow and more that there was what you could call overreach on the part of, weirdly, the Tories, that led to a
backlash.
They
do have a long history of cross-dressing.
That's true, yeah. That's my read. I'm not sure that's right. It's not an area of expertise.
Do you, one of you guys have touched on this, and this gets brought up a lot. J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, is always called a TERF now. She does not accept that designation, and she talks a lot about how she doesn't think that self-identified trans women should be immediately given access to all female spaces. Is she a TERF or not in your read? And also what's going on where not just the cast of Harry Potter, but like the generation that grew up with Harry Potter seems to really hate her guts now, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I would recommend my friend Andy Mills' podcast, The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. I thought it was really good. Most of her views I was debating writing about this, but even I'm not this masochistic. Most of her views are held by like 60 or 70% of the American and British public, like issue for issue. The one exception where I really disagree with her is like, she seems to have a problem with like trans women, I think based on her interview on this podcast, like using women's bathrooms. And I sort of think that's an area where like, we just need to compromise and let people use the bathroom they're most familiar with. Like when you get to other situations like sports or prisons or locker rooms, it gets a little bit more complicated than that. Bathrooms, I don't know. Overall, I think she's mostly expressing majority views, and there's a weird phenomenon where in liberal spaces, if you express a majority view, people try to really destroy you, which I don't think is conducive to open debate.
What do you think about the kind of hate that her readers seem to have for her, the Harry Potter generation?
There's like, I don't know. I've observed a little bit of arrested development. Like if you're, look, I'm not young. I'm almost 40. But if you're 40.
But you look older.
Thank you. Yeah. What was that? What was that response? Yeah,
it's kind of, you'll have to deal with your therapist about
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Yeah. I was supposed to have therapy tonight, actually. I'm doing this instead.
So that's wonderful.
There's people who have a little bit of arrested development. I think if you're my age, let's say, and you still really identify closely with like works of young adult fiction to the point where you feel betrayed because the author disagrees with you about stuff, I don't know. It just takes a certain type to get that worked up about that. And I think there's a lot of those types in the fantasy world.
Yeah.
I don't know if she was saying I'm one of those people or.
To summarize that comment, it sounds like somebody's getting really bad Christmas presents this year. But it might be about what's the role of social media in kind of, pylons and kind of polarization, particularly around gender ideology.
When you weren't sure whether your kid's non-binary identity was permanent, were they a maybe baby baby?
Ah, very good.
Took me a while to come up with that. I think obviously kids get validated by adopting these identities online. I mean, I've written this about this a little bit. You have 12-year-olds on the cusp of puberty who proudly announce that they're asexual and start putting the asexual flag, which I presume is just two people not fucking, on their Tumblr page. So you clearly, it's weird because it's obviously true in a global sense that people who are gender nonconforming are often not treated well. They are often oppressed. That's true. It's also true that if you're like a, hypothetically, a somewhat boring straight white lady who's 30, you might get a little bit of something about coming out as queer or non-binary. So I think it's silly to not acknowledge the role of that. And a lot of that stuff does take place on social media.
You somewhat notoriously got off of Twitter. So you're part of the solution.
Yeah, exactly.
You're no longer part of the problem.
Yes.
Why did you get off Twitter and how's that working for you?
I just had like a really bad relationship with it. It turns out that I think I'm right about a lot of stuff. And I have trouble not getting in arguments with people. I'll get in a fight with someone and then I'll click their profile and be like, this is literally a mentally ill 15-year-old from Ohio.
Yeah. And they just owned you.
And they wrecked me. And they're much smarter than me. I just realized it was time for a break. And I do think Twitter has a really negative effect on journalism. I mean, it sounds like a cliche at this point to say it, but every journalist is on Twitter. Every journalist knows how other people look. The Atlantic ran a really good article today about by Helen Lewis about the youth gender stuff. Read the responses to it on Twitter, many of them from other journalists. Imagine being in that situation, debating what to write about and what to say about it. It would affect you.
What do you think about the arguments about teen mental health and social media use, but also the way that Jonathan Haidt is doing a very public project along with Gene Twenge, I think, and a couple of other people? What do you think about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I should say it's a recent event. Robbie Suave is one of the main exemplars of this sort of anti-height position. I'm torn on it. I don't know. So on the one hand, I think a lot of, who was it? I think Stuart Ritchie is a science writer I really like. He wrote a book similar to mine, but more successful. He's done some good debunking of some of these studies. I know, even more successful.
Yeah, it's amazing.
A lot of the studies I think are weaker than you would expect them to be. I'm also like wary of like falling for this Luddism where it's like, oh, the latest technological innovation is going to destroy the youth. People said that about TV, jazz music, Dungeons and Dragons. Pinball. which wrecked my life. I had a whole other story. My intuition is that social media is a little bit different because this is a cliche, but we are social creatures. Sitting on your phone as a 13-year-old, constant social feedback about everything you say you do, seeing your friends posting their curated photos. It would surprise me if that didn't have an effect, at least on people who use it a lot and or who have other psychological problems. There's people I know who use Twitter. It doesn't affect them at all. I think it worsens my mental health. I really do. So it might be that there's sort of like heterogeneity in who's affected by it. But yeah, my unsatisfying answer is I don't think we know for sure, but given what we know about human psychology, it would surprise me if it didn't have an effect on some people.
What do you think about that? The larger framework of Haidt's project, though, where he's publishing stuff on Substack and invites comment, et cetera, that sounds like a pretty good way of doing things, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I'm not that familiar with it. Yeah. Peer review is really, really broken. We tend to valorize peer review. Like, if you read my Substack, you'll see a lot of examples of peer review studies that are garbage, frankly, and that never should have passed peer review. So this new... The replication crisis was in part sparked by bloggers, really smart bloggers who would say, I think this study's bullshit. I'm not going through the traditional gatekeepers who would reject my work. I'm just going to post it on a blog. So I think that's like an emerging, pretty exciting way to do science. The downside is anyone can post whatever they want. And we've seen examples of people who are treated as scientific experts who are quacks. But at this point, I really don't trust peer review. So I'm open to this idea that we should be more public and less peer reviewy. Yeah.
You've mentioned your mental health several times, and it seems to be deteriorating.
I'll kill you.
The longer we talk. We talk a lot about mental health now, certainly more than we did 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. How much of mental health issues do you think it's kind of supply side? We have more therapists, we have more therapy, every school has a counselor. Are we creating the mental health crisis that we're seeking to solve?
Yeah. I was with a friend of mine named Emmett Renzen last night who has suffered. What was that?
Who is?
Oh, he's a friend of yours.
Wow, that's really.
This is good audio.
Thank you for that intervention.
He and Freddie DeBoer are two writers who have suffered serious mental health problems themselves, and they have written about what Freddie calls the gentrification of mental illness. So
So he was in the insane asylum when it was cool.
Exactly.
Before the Starbucks got there.
Exactly, yeah. You get some social clout. Look, how can you deny there's social clout here when 15-year-olds are literally listing their self-diagnoses in their online profiles? There's something going on where it's seen as, obviously, we should not stigmatize mental health problems. We should speak openly about struggles. That's really important. But there's something weird going on where you do get some status from that. And I've written about this a little. My mom was like severely depressed. You would not confuse severe treatment-resistant depression for the sort of thing you like tweet about in a quirky way. It's like fucking brutal. It's very different. So there's something very off about mental health discourse. Emmett Renzen and Freddie DeBoer are both good folks to read on this.
Yeah. I guess to wrap things up, we'll still be talking and drinking, and Jesse's mental health will continue to deteriorate. It's funny, I'm struggling even to phrase this as a question, but are you optimistic or pessimistic? Because that doesn't seem like a scale that I think of in your work. Like
about this interview?
About journalism. Yeah. Now, this interview is a disaster. This is the Hindenburg of interviews. So, we don't have to worry about that. But are you optimistic about social change or the society we live in? Are you optimistic about journalism? Are we destroying ourselves, or are we creating the next great America?
I'm so unqualified to answer this. I think like a lot of things are going on at once. I'm overall pretty pessimistic because I've seen there's a lot of new technology that sort of seems to have a mind of its own. I mean, increasingly with the AI stuff, it really seems to have a mind of its own. I don't think we're like built evolutionarily to live in this sort of environment, just buffeted by this amount of information. So I'm sort of worried about that. I'm really worried about what happens the next time there's like a razor thin US presidential election. Mm-hmm. But overall, I think we're just going to like keep muddling along.
Well, we invade, Iraq or Afghanistan. We already
know. Thank you
know
for
that.
Asking. I've been saying for decades, Iran.
Yeah.
They have it coming.
All
so
right.
It's let's end on that note.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank Jesse Singel.
Thank you.
Talking. Thank you so much. Okay. So, and again, I want to thank John and Jen for hosting us.
Yeah, thank you, John.
We still got a lot of food and a lot of drink and a lot of conversation. Thank you all for coming out. Really appreciate it.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, subscribe. Go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcast, check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates, our other podcast offerings. I think you'll like them. If you like this, you'll love them. And also, finally, go to reason.com/events and see what we've got cooking, especially in the New York City area. Thanks for listening.